So is there any universal advice you could give to people who are perhaps in a similar position as you?
You should never ever compare yourself to anyone else. So you shouldn't be jealous, or you shouldn't be, and you should, depending on which side you are.
What's the question you always ask to a potential founder that you're thinking to back?
I ask them, why have they chose this path of suffering? I guess what I'm trying to gauge when I ask those questions is how dedicated, how committed, how ready to go through ups and downs, how ready to suffer they are.
So, in your eyes, Greg, is there a unique factor that makes a successful startup?
Being if you don't have those three things, it's going to be very, very, very hard to get to the end of it.
From humble beginnings to defying the odds, Gregory de Werp's unconventional journey led him to build Europe's largest venture capital firm dedicated to transforming the built world. In this episode of Bricks and Bytes, we uncover the secrets behind AO's success, their investment philosophy, and why the built world industry is ripe for disruption. We'll discover the untapped potential of the largest, least digitized, and most polluting industry on the planet, and how Greg's vision is shaping our future. If you're enjoying our podcast, you can support us by heading over to www.bricksbytes.show and signing up to our newsletter. This is an easy and free way which helps us keep the podcast going. In addition, you'll receive all of the key insights from each of the guests we have on, as well as some bonus content about what's going on in the wider world of construction tech. And now, an announcement from our sponsors. This episode is brought to you by Shift, helping contractors like you leverage BIM to secure a leading position in the race towards construction's digital future. Visit maketheshft.digital for more. This episode is brought to you by Build Vision, transforming construction supply chain by bringing contractors, manufacturers, and stakeholders onto a single software platform. Visit buildvision.io to find out more. Greg, so founder of AO, which is Europe's largest built world VC firm. How did it all start?
First of all, hi guys. Good to be here. I know we've been trying to do this for a while, so I'm excited to do this.
Thank you.
How did it start? Good question. I would say serendipity, 35 years in the making. I guess, you know, I have a long, unconventional journey that brought me into VC, that I would say started in my early days as a kid. Where, you know, I had bad odds stacked against me. And I've always had this, appeal, for the underdogs, this appeal for proving people wrong, and this appeal for defying bad odds, which is mostly what venture is about. And so after a long journey, I ended up doing what I think I was meant to be doing for forever. But as is life, you have to go through certain hoops, prove yourself, grow, develop as a human being and as a professional until the moment is right. And I think the moment was right for me when I started the firm.
Yeah. Were you always in finance from your vocation?
I started my career in investment banking. That was my first job out of college. I hated every bit of it, and woke up almost 10 years later, decided to escape for as long as I could. Not knowing what I was going to do, but knowing what I didn't want to do, which was be a banker for the rest of my life. And so went into entrepreneurship and became an entrepreneur in the real estate space. And so spent a few years doing that. And then the stars aligned for me to take everything that I've learned, all the experience, the reputation, the kind of also personal balance sheet to be able to build a venture firm, because it takes money and resources and sacrifices. And so came the time where I was ready and able to do it.
Mm-hmm. So I think there's quite a lot of people who know that what they don't want to do in life, but they are doing something. So is there any universal advice you could give to people who are perhaps in a similar position as you, that you definitely knew that you don't want to do investment banking, but you were not sure what you want to do?
First of all, no one should take any advice from me. but if anyone...
That's why you're here, by the way.
Yeah. If anyone wants to hear my opinion, I would say life is a long journey. There's a lot of ups and downs. And you should never, ever compare yourself to anyone else. So you shouldn't be jealous, or you shouldn't be, and you should remain humble depending on which side you are, because you never know in which direction journey goes. I think you have to have patience in your convictions. So all the great things that happen take time to happen. It takes time to build an amazing business. It takes time to build a successful business. It takes time to build a successful venture firm. Everything good takes time and it's painful. As we say, everything that you want stands across pain. So you have to go through pain to get to what you want. And so you need to have resilience, patience, and conviction, whatever you do. And the best advice that I would give myself, if I saw myself 15 years ago, is the best investments you'll ever make is the one you're doing yourself, the investment you're making yourself. So invest in yourself on and on and on until you get to where you want to be.
Yeah, very nice. So AO, largest built world VC firm. We'll get into the definition of built world, but where did the kind of like, where was it conceived? Like, where did you decide suddenly one day, you know what, there's an opportunity here. I want to go and help startups grow in this space.
So when I started my real estate company, this was a company that started as an advisory business and became an investment business in real estate. We did more than $4 or $5 billion of deals within 3 years, 3.5 years, partnering with large real estate private equity firms, REITs, publicly listed entities, co-investing with them, understanding really the real estate market from within. And it became very evident that there was going to be a point where technology and sustainability in the industry would become the driver of the industry. I could see that there was no venture firm doing this in Europe at scale. There was a few in the US doing it at scale, typical of US, usually always a bit ahead, a lot more ambitious. And I was a little bit frustrated that, again, we lacked ambition in Europe. We have a real estate market that's as big as the US. It's actually bigger than the US. We're miles ahead on everything related to thinking about sustainability and acting upon it. We have great academia. We have the oldest stock of building in the planet. We have all sorts of things that make technology in the sector something that could thrive in a meaningful way. But yet we didn't do it. The US guys were doing it. So that was really the genesis of all of this. Was I got to a point with my real estate business where I could stop thinking about the short term, could afford to think about the long term, and I could finally do something that would allow me to have a more meaning than just making money. And having the sense that you can make a positive dent into whichever world you live in. You can have mission and vision aligned. And this was the culmination of everything I'd ever done. And that was my entry door into VC, being able to leverage being in real estate, being an entrepreneur, being in finance, having gone through ups and downs of life and professional lives. And so decided to have a go at it.
So you didn't decide to follow the path of investing in instant delivery startups then?
I didn't. I probably would not have, for not the reason. I just didn't, you know. You often ask yourself as an investor, you know, what if I was offered to do Uber at seed stage, or what if I was offered to do... I don't know. I don't know if I would have done them. You know, it takes a vision and a confidence that probably I didn't have at the time where those companies emerged. And so no regrets. Let's focus on the future.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. How does one go about raising the fund in terms of the investors within the fund? So limited partners. Like, did you have connections at that time, or how did you manage to convince people starting the first fund?
Yeah, I just had the quantum physics board behind me, and that that helped.
Yeah,
but aside, I would say the first fund was raised entirely on pre-existing relationships of people, institutions that had experience in being in business with me, had transacted with me, had invested with me, had successfully done so with me, and that were ready to take a chance on a new endeavor. Frankly speaking, I don't think I would have been able to raise money with people that didn't know me before, because the reality is I had no credential whatsoever in venture, aside from, yeah, being an angel, having done a bunch of tech investments myself over the last 20 years, but then anyone can do it. So it took a leap of faith and a belief and trust from those investors to get into business. And so I am very grateful for that. Equally, they are not charitable organizations. And so there is a reason why they saw the potential, is because they knew me, and they have been in business with me for a while. And so there was a level of confidence and trust that every day I wake up, I want to make sure I repay this trust and this commitment, and I never go to sleep at night with contempt or feeling that I have. You know, it's a relentless pursuit of repaying those people who trust you with results, and it's a never-ending journey.
Yeah, I love that. What would you say was some, maybe like a key mistake and key lesson whilst building AO?
A lot of mistakes. I would say maybe first let's start with, like, you know, the lessons, or what does it actually take to raise a firm, to build a firm. And I think I always use this, you know, dual language, fund, firm. It's because a firm is really building a business. And sometimes I feel like entrepreneurs see VC investors as like this investor box, but they don't realize that behind that, there is actually entrepreneurs building a business. We have the same stakeholders. We have to raise money. We have to deploy. We have to do our job well. We have to hire people, keep them, let them go. I mean, it's just exactly the same. I think the lessons is you have to be extremely, extremely resilient, more than any other type of entrepreneur's journey, because it's the longest feedback loop you could ever imagine. Mm-hmm. It's going to be years and years and years and years before you actually know if you're onto the right thing, if you're into the right direction. It's full of surprises, twists and turns, doubts, sleepless nights. I think you need patience. Great things don't happen overnight. I think we lost sight of that in the heydays of 2021 and 2022, where people thought you could just build multi-billion dollar businesses in a few months. You can't, or at least not in a sustainable way. And every good thing comes as a result of pain and suffering and resilience. So you have to be patient. You have to be humble. You get slapped in the face more than once, and you have to be ready to revisit your preconceptions or your ideas. You have to be passionate, you have to be dedicated, and you have to be dependable. So meaning your stakeholders have to be able to depend on you, to rely on you, your investors, your portfolio companies, your employees. In terms of the mistakes, there's been a few. I would say on building the firm, I was faced with the pressure to build the firm. I had already raised the money before I actually built the firm, which was, it's just a bit like upside down.
Good position.
And so I had this urge. Actually, I don't know if it's a good position because it started as a blank piece of paper. It was about the vision, what we want to do, how we want to do it. But then you have to go and build it. You have to go and find the people. Mm-hmm. And I didn't even have a website, and I had the fund.
I guess there's like lots of temptation to deploy money quickly at that time when you have the money, but you don't have good ideas probably.
I'm a patient guy. So I didn't have the urge. I had the urge to try and do the best I could. And so it means along the way you feel rushed sometimes to hire more people quickly without having the time to really know if they're the right fit. And I think sometimes the mistakes come from hiring the wrong people. But more importantly, not letting them go fast enough when you realize they're not the right people. And I would say on the investment side, I think the mistakes that, you know, I might have made is overlooking the quality of the founder because the size of the opportunity that I target is so big, and focusing too much on, oh, it's such a huge opportunity that targeting, and maybe not emphasizing enough on the quality of the founder just because it's just a big market they're going into. I would say this would be two mistakes that, you know, I've made in the past that I'm learning every day.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Built World. So that can mean a few things to different people and even different investors that you speak to. So could you just give us your definition?
Sure. We have a quite a broad, and I would say a broadening definition. That's why you will not hear me use the word PropTech anymore. I think PropTech is limiting in the way we think about it. We think the built world sits at the core of everything we do as a society. It's the homes, the bridges, the infrastructure, the energy that enable us to function. And so the way we frame the built world, we have kind of a nice kind of taxonomy that we've been developing, is from as early as everything surrounding new materials, the supply chain that provide those materials, everything surrounding design, architecture, and engineering, meaning how we actually conceive those buildings or those infrastructure. It's the construction process. And then it's everything that happens once those buildings are built and everything that happens in and around those buildings. So think about building operation, building management, energy efficiency, energy transition, electrification, building to grid, the adjacencies with how the built world enables new forms of mobility, all the way to the end of life of a building and how to make sure we enable circular economy and so on. That's kind of the playground. That's where we invest. That's what we think about all day, every day. And I would say our investment thesis is we invest in the positive transformation of the built world. Positive transformation has obviously a sustainability decarbonization connotation, but it's not enough. So our view is we think that we need to invest in those very important kind of decarbonization or climate resiliency focused solution, because the built world is the most polluting industry in the world. So there is a clear role to play in enabling our society to transition. But it's not enough because it's such a large, fragmented, antiquated industry that unless and until you invest in the digital transformation and data science side of the industry to create and make it a more fertile ground for innovation, your sustainability focused solution will be limited in their scope and their scale and their impact. And so for me and for us as a firm, it's the combination of those kind of impact focused or impact enabling solutions that will yield the greatest, I would say, return, but also the greatest impact. And so although we're not an impact fund, we think a lot about enabling impactful change as a result and as a byproduct of our of our investment activity. So that would be the way I frame it.
Just quickly, what is Impact Fund, by the way?
So I would say an impact fund is, and traditionally funds who label themselves as impact fund, they solely focus on impact. So sustainability, for example, and there's all sorts of ways to define it in Europe. There's some regulation around it. Mm-hmm. So that can be quite limiting in the mandate if you only do that.
I understand.
Because then you can't really look at what we look at, which is the digitalization as a platform to enable faster change.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Brilliant. So I just want to touch on your definition on the build world. So I think it's very broad. And in terms of opportunities in technology within built world, where do you see is the greater or maybe larger a number of opportunities within the design and construction space or after the building is built and handover?
Look, we look at it holistically. Our view is from the top down is it's the largest industry in the world. It's the least digitized one. It's the most polluting one. Go and help yourself. There's a lot to do at every step of the way. If you focus purely on the sustainability front, the stat is, 40% of emissions come from the built world as a whole. Of that 40%, one third is from the embodied carbon. So everything that happens up to and including the construction of an asset. And then two thirds of that 40% is the operational carbon emission, which is everything that happens once the building is built. So you could argue that there's a lot to do on existing operations of building, particularly because in developed economies like Europe or the US, about 90% of the buildings that will be here in 2050 are already built. So there's a lot of work, there's a lot of retrofitting to do. So that's a huge opportunity. And it's about $100 trillion that we need to go into retrofitting our existing stock of building. I don't think there's ever been a bigger CapEx super cycle in any industry, at least not that I know of. Now, the flip side of that is construction, architecture, engineering, construction is massive because you sit at the core of enabling better, greener, cheaper buildings from the conception phase. And this is particularly like three verticals that have lagged in digitalization. If you take architecture, productivity has gone down over the last 20 years, unlike any other industry. So there's a lot of productivity gains, efficiency gains that can come from technology. So it's equally as important because it sits at really the inception of the life cycle of any building. So we think they're all equally interesting in size and shape, in effectively the type of technologies that you're going to be able to implement. Everything in architecture and engineering and design is more software related. Everything that is in building operation is a mix of software, hardware as well. So it's kind of different investment profiles.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, to me, it sounds like it obviously covers a lot of topics. So do you have like some kind of dynamic, Greg, within maybe the firm or the team where like maybe when you're thinking about who you're hiring and that kind of thing, that someone has a very specialized sort of knowledge within each of those areas? Because, yeah, like we say, it's broad.
I would almost say we are generalists within the built world. If you look at our team today, we have an investment team, a research team, and a data science team. They all play different critical roles in our investment, our portfolio management.
How big is
the investment? With 14, we've just made a new hire, so I think 14, yeah. Mm-hmm. Or 13, I need to double check, because we have someone who's recently left us. Every person in the investment team is developing areas of expertise that they already had before coming, or that they've nurtured or grown or expanded since joining. And they become the experts in those different verticals. And so as a firm, we build a thesis from the top down. We develop investment thesis, certain verticals that we like for all sorts of reasons. We tend to focus on real must-have technologies, so stuff that is creating real ROI, either on the operational side, on the financial side, on the emission side. And they tend to be more B2B kind of in nature, but we also have done some B2C. And so each member of the team will have areas of expertise, whether it's electrification or digital twins or AAC software, and then they basically will be captains of certain investment thesis building that we do and us going into the market to look for those companies. You need to build those pool of knowledge and you need to supplement them with a good network of experts, advisors that surround the firm that could help you because you will look at AI, you look at software, you look at deep tech, you look at hardware. They're all very, very different in nature in how you underwrite an investment, how you should think about capitalizing it, and the type of return profiles that you should be expecting. And so they're all interesting to us. We build a portfolio. That's the beauty of building a portfolio, is you have kind of this barbell approach where you stack different type of companies depending on their stage. You know, we invest from seed to series B, depending on the geographic scope, the vertical that they target, their nature, i.e. software, hardware, deep tech, AI, etc. And we try to build kind of a high conviction portfolio that is well balanced in amongst those different kind of vectors.
Brilliant. So you are one of the interviews I think you gave, you mentioned Evergreen Fund. That was your first fund, I think, or can you explain what is Evergreen Fund and like how does it tie into like a construction or build tech world?
Yeah, so our first fund was Evergreen. Our second fund is traditional closed-ended structure. Evergreen means it's a fund that never ends. It means it's a fund where, in theory, you never have to repay money to investors. You can continuously recycle it and grow and grow and grow. Almost think about if it was a corporate that just has its balance sheet, invest, gets an exit, reinvest into new deals and grow and grow and grow. This was the idea originally. Allows you to be a lot more patient in your approach because you don't have an end date. You don't have a ticking clock that says, hey, it's soon the end of the investment period. You need to have deployed X, Y, Z. So it's a very differentiated approach to investing portfolio construction. I personally think it's the best capital one could ever have, but it's also a difficult one to raise. It was difficult to raise back in the day. It's quasi impossible, I would say, to raise.
Everyone wants returns, right?
Yes, and there's different liquidity needs at the moment. So we had to shift because to continue building the platform and the fund and expanding our LP base, particularly to the type of institutions, endowment, insurance companies that we have as LPs, you need to have a very specific liquidity profile or illiquidity profile that is hard to do with an evergreen structure, unless the LP itself has an evergreen capital, which some do, some family offices, some corporates, but it's not the majority.
Mm-hmm. So there is like a few metrics, not metrics, well, maybe metrics we kind of prepared. So as the largest European built world VC firm, we need to back this statement with some numbers. So maybe if you can shed some light onto stuff like assets under management or internal rate of return. Is that okay to share these?
I'm not against sharing it. I have to be careful because when you start sharing performance, it could be considered as marketing and we're regulated. So I have to thread carefully in what I say. So disclaimer, this is not me marketing. This is not anything of that matter. I'm not suggesting anyone should invest in our funds. but if you ask me, with the closing of our new fund, which is in process, we will be at 500 million AUM. In terms of multiples and IRR, I would say that we hover currently around the 30% IRR mark. With the vintage of our funds, we have two funds out now, active and in the market. I would say we're between 2 and 3x on those two vintages, which effectively is, I think, top decile for our vintages.
Nice. Okay. I think we should talk about Built World stuff specifically, and then we'll move on to actually the like what you're looking for when you're investing, Greg, in startups. But to kick this sort of like the Built World stuff, we'll talk a little bit about retrofitting, because I know based on some research I've read from you guys, you're quite bullish on retrofitting. But to start that, what's the question you always ask to a potential founder that you're thinking to back?
I ask a few questions. I ask what keeps them up at night. I ask them why have they chose this path of suffering of entrepreneurship, because it's about choosing your pain, and why did they choose this pain over another? And what would they be doing if it wasn't this? I guess what I'm trying to gauge when I ask those questions is how dedicated, how committed, how passionate, how ready to go through ups and downs, how ready to suffer they are. And usually if you ask what keeps them up at night and nothing does, then also that's necessarily a good sign. I have a lot of things keeping me up at night. So I would imagine that for any entrepreneur, it should be the same, whether it's business or personal.
Mm-hmm. So you're basically saying that entrepreneur character over the idea and the market size.
For sure. I mean, 100%. I like to say that resilience is more important than intelligence by far. It's not the smartest guys that are the most successful. It's the most resilient ones.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Martin, what keeps you up at night?
What me? Keeps me up at
night? Martin.
Oh, you. Ah, sorry. Martin, actually, what keeps you up at night?
What keeps me up at night?
This isn't an audition, by the way, for your AO pitch day.
I probably, Gregory, wouldn't qualify for your investment right now.
That's such a cop-out. That's a ridiculous answer. Mm-hmm. Hey, okay, let's move on. Okay, so yeah, Greg, I mentioned a piece of research you guys. Oh, by the way, your research is absolutely fantastic. I'd highly recommend anyone listen to this to go check that out on your website.
All credit to Catriona and Jasmita, who are leading our research and data efforts. They do a great job. I have almost nothing to do with it, to be completely honest. And I say this proudly, because we have amazing people on the team.
That's what you need. So those are a research paper you released called State of the Built World Tech. So it's showing that retrofitting had the highest investment, so the number of deals and total number of dollars invested. It seemed like we went through a phase, I couldn't remember when, but within the last year or so, where every other word was retrofit. So you as AO, why, like, what makes one retrofit company stand out over another? Like, where do they get it right? Where do they go wrong?
Yeah, I would say operational excellency, capital efficiency, focus, keeping your customer acquisition cost under great control, thinking about how to become a platform rather than a one-dimensional kind of tool that people could use. These are the things that come to mind. And so we've made a few investments in the space, and it's because we believe the space is massive. There's just no going around or getting around the fact that we need to retrofit stuff. It's mm-hmm. particularly true for Europe, where we have the oldest housing stock in the world. We've had an energy crisis, and even though people don't think about it anymore or as much as they used to, we've discovered as a society that we were tremendously exposed to the volatility in energy prices. And I think one thing that is certain is that geopolitical volatility is there to stay in this day and age. And so we're likely to see more of those things happen for different all sorts of reasons. So when you put that together at a time where the European regulatory landscape is as keen as ever to get things going, there is kind of a perfect storm. And the what we like is it's not going to get solved in a week or in a year or in 5 years. It's a multi-decade process. So you have the ability to really project yourself in building a category-defining business over the long term. This is not a fad. This is not, oh, I set up a business, make loads of money over the next 3 years, and then close shop. This is something that's there to stay. So there are some pitfalls. There are, you know, a lot of businesses that are trying to get into the space. There are different ways to look at the retrofitting, and that's what we've done. We slice and dice it in different ways, which allows you to make multiple investments in the space by looking at it from a different kind of lens. There is, let's say, investing in the platformization of to enable people to go through the retrofitting process. That's kind of enter. They are the one-stop shop that takes you through the journey from A to Z in a seamless, kind of very intuitive way. And it's kind of what was the missing piece of the puzzle. Like if I wanted to go through the retrofit of my house, I wouldn't even know where to start. Can I get a grant? Where do I get the energy audit? How do I connect with installers? By the way, there's no installers. Can I get green financing? All those things are very interesting. So that's kind of one way to look at it, is the platform, digitalization platform side of things. There is also investing in specific new technologies that will be part of the retrofitting kind of toolbox, you know, new types of heat pumps or things like that. And then there is a third element, which is very, very important for us, is you could drop ship 5 million heat pumps tomorrow in Europe. It wouldn't change a thing because there's nobody to install it, or at least there's not enough people to install it. So investing in technology to enable labor upskilling, to enable us to tap into a lower skill workforce to be able to respond to this demand in retrofitting, whatever they are, solar, heat pumps, insulation, you name it. But equally, if you reverse it and you put also a little bit your European thinking cap on, we have today in Europe a lot of immigration. A lot of people are eager to work. We don't always, if you look at the respective governments in Europe, they don't always know how to integrate them nicely. And that's a problem. And so if you can, again, leverage technology to upskill the workforce, to enable people to enter the workforce, to have them kind of participate in this super cycle of retrofitting, to enable them to have kind of a job, I think that's also quite amazing. And so the retrofitting is very fragmented on the supply side. There's a lot of small electricians, et cetera. So again, these are small, medium businesses that are in dire need of digitalization, new tools, et cetera. So there's a lot of ways to look at that. So we've done investments across the board and we continue to do so. But there's a lot of businesses that are trying to emerge in the space, different countries. It's down to the team, the stellar execution, kind of the ability to not compete because you have just more money, so you pay a lot more for leads. It's compete because you are just the best at what you do operationally. You provide the best experience, and you're able to have the best kind of KPIs from a margin standpoint.
Mm-hmm. So what are the KPIs for a category winner within retrofitting? In your view,
again, it really depends where you are and kind of the ecosystem I've deployed, but I've kind of explained. But I would say it's really kind of customer acquisition cost is a really big topic because as you get more competitive and more commoditized, it's easy to fall into the traps of paying more to acquire your customers. And it's about entrepreneurs and businesses who are thinking outside the box on how to create partnership platforms, network effects, so that they can effectively divert, detach themselves from just paid leads, and create really a platform where you have multiple sources of demand sourcing in order to kind of diversify and reduce the risk to be overly reliant on one channel that might become expensive as you have more entrants into the market.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, Greg, you mentioned Enter, which we can ask you about in a minute. Something you recently also just invested in was Varm. So as I understand it, Varm install insulation into is it bear with my arrogance, but is it into like entire houses or just within a roof space?
No, so insulation is kind of the low-hanging fruit. I mean, you guys and I live in the UK. There is literally wind in my house, when, even when the doors and the windows are closed. So insulation is a low-hanging fruit that can really, at the lowest kind of cost, lower basket size, reduce your kind of energy loss and your emissions by 30-40% if it's done properly. So it's entire homes that you retrofit.
Yeah. So I think you kind of answered the question. It was really like, why invest in like a one-stop shop with Enter that does like seems to do everything versus like someone like Varm, which is just focusing on insulation. But if there's low hanging fruit, then it makes sense because there's obviously a market there.
It's a low hanging fruit. They have a slightly different approach. So they're not competing with each other. It's not that Enter doesn't do insulation and Varm does it. Enter is more the platform that enables you to enter the retrofitting process. They do an energy audit. They will tell you, this is the payback and ROI on each initiative, solar, new windows, LEDs, heat pump, insulation as well. Then they connect you with the installers and so on. Varm is focusing on owning and creating excellency in the install segment. It's almost a way, again, it's more akin to leveraging technology, processes, operation to upskill kind of the installer business on the insulation side. And so it's more towards that. So you could see a scenario where Varm are providing the insulation works to the Enter platform.
Mm-hmm. Got you. And the skill set, yeah.
I'll be very tempted to say that there won't be like a category winner within this, within the retrofit, because it's so complicated. But I might be overthinking it from engineering point of view, as looking at the housing stock, every type of construction is slightly different, and it's very difficult to retrofit everything in one way. Obviously, on the platform level, it's very nice and simple. You can gather large market share, but then going into the into the workings of this, it just gets super complex. Building by building, different techniques needs to be applied.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. There's no one silver bullet. It's a collection of initiatives and undertakings and technologies and that will enable you to make a home more sustainable, more efficient. I think, yeah, you can't, like, there are some clear kind of winners that are going to see the biggest velocity, whether it's heat pump, solar, because, you know, they are creating the best ROI and so on. I think you're right. There's going to be multiple winners depending on the different categories. I think you could have a winner on the platform side because the platform is agnostic to which technology or initiatives is the most used. Is just they are the enablers of the retrofitting. So I think you could see platform that are going to outperform the rest because they get the scale, the efficiency, the synergies that you only get when you get to a certain side.
Yeah, that's actually begs the question, like if built world is a physical world, right? But we seem to be innovating the easiest within the platform and software space. We struggle really to get the hardware, the tangible stuff to innovate. Have you got any thoughts on this?
I actually disagree. We've seen companies that have a hardware component, or whether it's software-enabled hardware, that are doing extremely well. The reality is, there are things you can't simply solve with just software, particularly when you try to get involved in everything around sustainability or decarbonization. There needs to be some form of hardware. Hardware, I know historically hasn't been kind of a darling in venture, but I think you have to think that not all the hardware are equal. It depends on kind of what is your supply chain, what is your distribution strategy. You can be asset light and have an hardware component into your business. You can scale fast and have an hardware component. You can have great margin and have a hardware component. It really depends how you wrap things and how you build your business around. So you have amazing companies in the portfolio like Passive Logic in the US, like Span in the US, who have a hardware component and are doing really, really well. So I think it's the devil is in detail, and it's about the business models that you build around those specific types of technologies.
Okay, let's look at Enter. So just recently raised 19.4 million euros. You was one of the investors, Greg. We've heard some good things about the company generally, like they've got a great team, and you only have to do like some basic research to understand sort of the caliber of the people in the company. So why Enter?
Yeah, why did I enter? So we actually invested before that round. We were part of the first few institutional investors in this company, together with our friends at Fundamental. And so we had early conviction into the team opportunity. And I would just say we were proving very right in our conviction so far. I would say that the team have exceeded our expectation in how professional, how mature, how level-headed they've been. And they're building an amazing company. So, I don't have much to say that, you know, we backed what we thought was a great team ended up being an amazing team.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, cool.
And I think from Enter's point of view, as it is about platform, it's fairly easy to scale it on into other markets, at least European markets and the UK market. Would you agree or disagree?
I think they have an approach that allows them to scale geographically. There is there's a hyper-local element to the platform, which is you need to source the right network of installers and stuff. But that's not rocket science. And then the ways in which you do it, I think, are to some extent highly replicable from one country to another. So right now, they're very, very busy in Germany. There's a lot to do in Germany. They can be busy for a while, but obviously the idea is to become eventually a pan-European platform.
Make them come here so we won't have these winds in the houses.
Somebody come and fix Greg's windy house, please.
Yes, please.
So, like, yeah, scaling across Europe, there's this sort of like issue with a labor shortage. It's prominent in construction, and I guess it does overspill slightly into maybe the retrofit market as well. So how do these platforms plan to tackle this, do you know?
The labor shortage?
Yeah.
Particularly when it relates to retrofitting or in general?
I think because the skill set is similar to those people that are working on like the trades in construction, right? So people fitting these are electricians, plumbers, maybe general labor. But the consensus and factually there is a labor shortage, which is only going to get worse. So we obviously need the people to be able to fit these things.
It's technology, as exactly what I was saying before, is leveraging tech to upskill workers and to be able to expand the pool of workers that are eligible and able to eventually get trained to take on those types of work. So with the state of population in Europe and kind of where it's going from a macro standpoint, there is a dire need of labor upskilling. And we think technology is going to play a key role in doing that and increasing productivity and enabling us to actually fulfill the demand that will be required to improve our built environments, which is going to be a lot of homes, a lot of retrofits, a lot of heat pumps, a lot of solar roofs. And so we need more people that can do those. And again, there's only one way to do it is through technology.
Yeah. Martin, one last question on this, I think, and then we'll go on to building a built world startup.
Yeah, so I recently have been listening to a podcast, I think it was in Poland. I'm Polish. So, and they were saying that there's lots of new regulations coming into Poland in terms of retrofitting existing buildings. And where it's coming from, it's coming from the European Union, which makes me think that the regulations will be very which will be a tailwind for this type of companies and this industry from pushing. Yeah, it will be a tailwind for retrofitting, really. What's your take on regulation and helping companies start up to retrofit Europe, broadly speaking?
Regulation play an enormous role in progressing the movement, but it's not the only tailwind. If it was the only tailwind, we would not be investing, because regulations can be volatile, particularly at times where you have political instability, like you have in most European countries, where political agendas or misguided political agendas get in the way of actually doing the right thing. And so there are other tailwinds that are equally as important. I think the customer demand, meaning, you know, if you're a tenant or if you want to get a specific tenant in your building, in your multifamily, in your office building, you're going to have to demonstrate that your building is in line with whatever net zero ambition that corporate has. So, you know, 10, 20 years, 15 years ago, you know, you had Amazon making net zero pledges as a corporate. And when Amazon makes that pledge, they commit to decarbonize the entirety of the supply chain by a certain date. And so when they do that, it means that they commit to decarbonize the real estate operations. In the case of Amazon, it is their headquarters, their offices, their logistics, their warehouses. And so if you own any of those assets that, and you want Amazon to be a tenant or buy this asset, unless you can demonstrate that it's accretive to the net zero plans, you will not be able to do so. And so what was true for maybe a handful of companies 10 years ago that were making those pledges is true for any credible corporate today. So that's putting a lot of pressure. And there's a lot of pressure from the capital markets. So lenders, banks are less likely to, completely unlikely to lend against a home or a building that is not compliant with upcoming emission standards. And so this is an industry where money talks. Forget about whether people want to do the right thing or not, whether mm-hmm. people have altruism or not. Mm-hmm. It's going to be a financial decision for the most part. So you'll mm-hmm. get a fine from the regulators, or you get your assets stranded. You will not be able to rent out or sell your assets. Your bank will not lend you or lend you a lot less at a much more expensive rate. All of this combined is catastrophic for the present value of any real estate assets. And that's even ignoring some of the additional tailwinds we have in Europe, such as the exposure to energy prices volatility, which comes directly to eat into households' pockets, as we've all experienced over the last few years. And that's a big driver of retrofitting.
Mm-hmm. Okay, dokie. Right, so in your eyes, Greg, is there a unique factor that makes a successful startup? If you can relate that specifically to the built world, then do. But if you feel like there is more general factor, and then also one unique factor specifically for the built world, then give us two. If not, give us a combination.
I mean, the factors that allow entrepreneurs to build a successful business are the same regardless of any industry you're in. I come back to the same point: being resilient, being patient, and being relentless. If you don't have those three things, it's going to be very, very, very hard to get to the end of it. And so that's what you need, regardless of what you do, where you do it, how you do it. If you go into the excruciating journey of becoming an entrepreneur, you have to be ready to suffer for a long time. You have to be ready to pick yourself up, and you have to be ready to not need a tap on the shoulder of someone telling you you're doing great. You just need to know it. You need to have a lot of patience in your conviction. As we said earlier, it takes a long time to change the world. And so be patient. when it comes specifically to the built world, I think you need to understand who your customer, who your ultimate customer is when you build a product. So this is a very fragmented industry. You have the tenant, you have the owner, you have the property manager, the asset manager, the facility manager, you name it. And so when you look at it from the outside and you don't necessarily understand the granularity or the fragmentation of the industry, you might be solving for the wrong customer. Hmm. And you might create a value proposition that is not solving the problem for the end customer. It's solving a problem for one of the participants, but not the ultimate customer. And so really to understand who you're catering to is very important. And also creating and developing a must-have technology is critical. There's a lot of stuff. We see a lot of companies every year. We see more than 1,000 companies every year. A lot of them are nice to have. Nice to have doesn't sell, particularly at a time where real estate stakeholders are going through an existential crisis as a result of the end of free liquidity. And so being a must-have technology, understanding what that means, and the way we frame it is you need to have a clear ROI for your end customer. Your end customer needs to become incredibly more efficient operationally or financially or from an emission standpoint by using your product. If they don't, then you have to go back to the drawing board because it's very unlikely that they'll have the interest, the bandwidth, or the budget to care for what you're doing.
Mm-hmm. So you just mentioned profitability. What's your thoughts on the profitability of a startup? Does it need to be profitable, or there is a long path to profitability? Is there how do you approach when you're thinking about investing into someone, into a team? How do you see profitability within the business, or it depends?
So you have to live within your means as a business. I think is the first thing that we've always thought about. But again, at some point, a lot of people lost their way into what that meant. And you need to have a clear path to a profitable business. That doesn't mean that you have to be profitable and break even from the get-go, but it means that you need to be very focused on how to get there, being able to turn the tap on and off to adjust to market, you know, ups and downs. And you have to stay in control of your own destiny for as long as possible. You need to iterate for as long as possible, and you need to never be in a position where you can, you're at the mercy of your expenditures. So, it means creating a business that you understand from top to bottom, not creating a black box business where you actually don't know what works, what doesn't, where the money goes, and stay agile and keep your finger on the pulse of the business at any point in time so you can make the good and the tough decisions along the way to continue expanding this ability to iterate. So that's kind of how we usually try to think or have our businesses think about it.
Mm-hmm. And how do you think about teams building startups in the built world where founders are not from construction industry? Is it a benefit or is it a drawback?
I think in some cases it could be amazing. Actually, we've backed companies, particularly because they were not coming from that industry and they came at it with a completely fresh pair of eyes. They would question everything. They would unturn every single stone and they would have zero legacy thinking, i.e., oh, why are you doing this? Well, I'm doing it because that's how we've been doing it for 20 years.
We've been doing this for 25 years.
Yeah. So we've backed, for example, the guys at 011H in Spain. They come from e-commerce, complete different organization and industry. But the way they've dissected and turned this around and looked at the construction industry with a fresh pair of eyes is mind-blowing. And seeing them become more and more expert, in some respect, better experts than some people who have been doing this for 30 years, after every board has been one of the greatest things to see over the last couple of years.
Mm-hmm.
Very nice. Could you tell us what it looks like to raise funds with AO? So what is that kind of, what's the typical sort of process with you guys?
So someone raising money from us?
Correct.
Yeah. We're fast. We're flat structure. We're approachable. We're high conviction. We operate in the verticals that we understand very well. So we can get to a yes or no fairly fast, at least on the principle of whether to really dig deeper into a business. Mm-hmm. We tend to know what we're looking for. And so the process is pretty smooth. We think that every process that a company runs with us, regardless of the outcome, i.e. whether we decide to invest or not, or whether they decide to take our money or not, that journey, that due diligence process, those interactions, this engagement should have added some value and be productive for them. So if we can ask the right question, the tough question, the hard questions, and that at least help promote more thinking, more challenge into those organizations, whether or not they decide to work with us, I would like always to them to conclude that it was great to have interacted with us. It's not always going to be the case. Some people will be a bit emotional if we decide not to do a deal or vice versa. But we try to be as pragmatic and candid as possible.
Mm-hmm. Gregory, what about some VCs that we spoke with, they would say that they wouldn't invest in a founder who is a single founder. They would only invest in teams or where there are at least two founders. What is your approach to a single founder startup?
Well, I'm a single founder, so I have a bias. I don't see why not. Some of the most successful people on the planet are single founders. Mm-hmm. So it feels a little bit presumptuous for some investors to just limit their thinking already around has to be a minimum of two. I understand why it's good to have a team. I understand what is key man risk. I understand that if there's a single founder and he gets run over by a truck, which is, by the way, the same question I get asked by LPs, what happens if you get hit by a truck? I understand those things. But I think, you know, some people, some businesses can be very, very well run by a single founder that's well surrounded by a great team. I have many, many, many examples of this across many different industries, whether it's tech, whether it's industry. So I don't discriminate.
Very good. Did you hear that, single founder? Be resilient and keep pushing.
What about first-time founders versus second or third or whatever time? Serial.
Everyone needs to start from somewhere.
No discrimination. again, some of the most successful businesses were first-time founders. I think there's an issue in Europe is that a lot of investors would not give a chance to an unsuccessful second-time founder, where actually you should give him or her a chance because there are some amazing learnings from failing. You never fail as long as you learn. So I think that's the mentality that there is in the US. It doesn't matter if you fail 10 times.
Yeah.
People will still want to back you at the 11th time, provided, of course, that you have the maturity and the humility to understand where your shortcomings were and learn from it and grow. So always happy to back first-time founders. I was a first-time venture GP, and people backed me. So, as I said, I like to back the underdogs. It comes from my early years, and I always continue to do so.
Mm-hmm. Nice. Where do you see the next sort of 5 to 10 years, Greg? Like, what should startups maybe come into the space or building? Did you sigh at the question, or is it just a general sigh? Because I know VCs hate to make predictions.
You know, we always say you make plans and life happens. I think directionally, I know where we're going. I know where we want to be. I only focus on a couple of things. I don't focus on how much money we have, how much AUM, doesn't matter. I focus on us being the best in the business, us being able to keep and attract the best people in the business, to take care of our people internally. It's very important. It's as important for me how we, the growth of our people internally, than it is for the growth of our portfolio companies. And it's very important that we don't lose sight of who we are and our DNA with time, with scale, or with success. I want us to be the same people in 5 years, same people meaning from a DNA and core values. I hope we're better people because we've learned, we've grown, we've improved. But fundamentally, our foundational core values should be the same. I don't want us to lose ourselves. I've seen that too many times. You become big, you become a lot of people, and you forgot who you are as a firm. And I think it's a business that has to remain a business where who you are matters. It's not about the AUM or the logo. It's who the people, it's a people's business. Who the people behind the logo or the name are. And that's the people, as an entrepreneur, you're going to get on your board for the next 10 years. These are the people that are hopefully going to go to war with you and for you. It's not the logo of the firm, it's the people. So I want us to be the same people, the same values for as long as possible.
Brilliant. Yes. Gregory, so do you also invest outside of Europe?
Yes. 40% of our portfolio is in the US.
Okay. What differences do you see, if any, between startups, founders in Europe and the US? You already mentioned that it's probably the different approach to the failure, but there is anything else apart from that?
I would say in general, in the US, you fail or you succeed much faster. And that's why the ecosystem in the US grows faster than the one in Europe. I think in Europe, you could be average for longer, and it takes longer to succeed in a lot of the cases. So that's changing. We're becoming more ambitious. We're becoming less risk averse, more focused on the upside in Europe as investor. And that's also changing a little bit the mindset. But I would say there is this amazing thing that in the US where people just have this confidence, belief, and conviction that everything is possible. Everything and anything is possible. Mm-hmm. We lack that in Europe. I wish we had more of that in Europe. And we have all the ingredients to be this way in Europe. We're not yet. And I think we have to become. Otherwise, Europe is at risk of falling behind even more.
What's the problem with us Europeans then that we know we are so risk averse? Like, is it like cultural or is it our DNA? What is your thinking?
I don't know. I think it's just anchored in our DNA. I think it's just the nature of people. Maybe it's down to the history and
the Vikings.
Yeah. You know, there's a lot of things that I don't necessarily love about the US. But like this self-belief and this notion that doesn't matter who you are, where you come from, you can do anything is amazing. And it's so inspiring to see. And so we have to learn. There's a few things we need to take from the US, and that's one of them.
Very nice. Mm-hmm. Okay, Greg, can you tell people where they can find out more about AO? And maybe if you're looking for any particular startups to come to, or what kind of deals?
You can find us and reach out to us on our website. There is all the emails and contact details. We want to meet resilient, relentless, passionate people that want to change the built world. And if they do, we should be their partner of choice, and we'll go to war with them and roll up our sleeves until they get to where they belong.
Very nice. All right, Greg, thank you.
Thank you, guys.